DW Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. On today's programme, Irish soldiers in Lebanon and dissident civilians in Belarus. Plus, the long shadow cast by Norway's worst ever oil platform disaster.
It was upside down. And there was a lot of people in the water outside this lifeboat. Together, we managed to communicate with those inside. And we managed to tilt it so we came on the right position.
Those stories and more coming up on the show. This week, a tense standoff between Irish peacekeeping troops and Israeli soldiers who had taken up positions uncomfortably close to the outpost where they were stationed as part of the UN's interim force in Lebanon, or UNIFIL, ended with the IDF withdrawing from the immediate area. It also thrust Ireland's long-standing involvement with the UN's Lebanon mission into the public consciousness. To find out more about the history of Irish involvement in Lebanon, I turned to Dr. Edward Burke, Director of University College Dublin's International War Studies MA programme and Assistant Professor in the History of War since 1945.
I mean, it goes back right to the early 80s, so we have more than four decades of Irish peacekeepers being part of UNIFIL, with really very little interruption. Obviously, there's a smaller presence now than there was in the 1980s. It was a very different mission then, of course. And so now we're looking at a situation where, you know, Ireland has just over 300 peacekeepers in UNIFIL. In terms of troop numbers, you know, we're looking at major contributions from Indonesia, from India, from Malaysia. We've also got European contingents as well. So it's a very large peacekeeping mission. But Ireland has, of course, got a very strong sense of attachment to Lebanon because of the many thousands of Irish soldiers who have served there.
And presumably also a lot of close relationships that have been built up over the years with the local population.
Oh, certainly. Very much so. You know, really close relationship going back many decades. You know, generations of Lebanese families often, you know, remain in close contact with, you know, Irish peacekeepers, and indeed retired soldiers have connections there. Many Irish soldiers, because of the size of our military, which is, you know, now never really goes beyond 10,000 strong, we sort of have soldiers rotating on multiple tours there over their careers, and so they get to know, you know, they've got to know the area particularly well. I mean, however, the mandates have, of course, changed a lot. There was UN Security Council Resolution 511, which initially sort of, you know, was passed in 1982 after the Israeli invasion of Lebanon then, and it gave, you know, UNIFIL additional tasks such as protection of civilians. After the war of 2006, you know, again, another Israeli invasion of Lebanon to try and force Hezbollah out of, or at least to, you know, inflict significant damage on Hezbollah in the south of Lebanon, we obviously saw UN Security Council Resolution 1701. And that was a substantially different mission than for UNIFIL, to the point that some people informally know it as kind of UNIFIL 2. It created in some ways a much more complicated mission for UNIFIL. It wasn't simply about monitoring or sort of, you know, trying to bring about a cessation of hostilities and indeed, you know, sort of creating a blue line between the combatants, particularly between Hezbollah, but also Amal, of course, another, you know, predominantly Shia paramilitary organization in the south of Lebanon. It wasn't just about sort of blue lines and cessation of hostilities and, you know, enabling the delivery of humanitarian supplies and the protection of civilians. Now it was about extending the reach, particularly of the Lebanese state, or the Lebanese armed forces into South Lebanon, ensuring ultimately that these armed non-state actors, not least Hezbollah, would go away and that the Lebanese armed forces would gain ultimately a monopoly of violence in the south of Lebanon together with the regular Lebanese police. Obviously, that's proved to be extremely difficult and you know, UNIFIL has not been successful in realizing that ambition. So there's been, you know, substantial changes in the mandate. And of course, that has profoundly affected the Irish Defence Forces, Irish peacekeepers' relationship with the local population.
I mean, if that was UNIFIL 2, are we looking now at UNIFIL three? I mean, how would you sort of place the mission and the position that it's found itself in recent weeks?
Well, in some ways, it would be, you know, maybe back to the future. I think it depends on what happens over the next number of weeks in terms of the, you know, the intensity of the fighting in southern Lebanon. But I suspect that UNIFIL will have a lot of tasks, you know, around the delivery of humanitarian assistance and indeed the reconstruction of southern Lebanon after the intensive fighting that we're seeing already and probably will see in the coming weeks. But it could be back to the future in terms of, certainly right now, in terms of the Lebanese armed forces are not a major belligerent at the moment. We'll see what happens in terms of, you know, the war between that is primarily between Hezbollah and the Israel Defense Forces. So that could change. You know, the Lebanese armed forces may actually be dragged into this conflict. But UNIFIL's 1701 mandate, I think we're just going to have to completely review the purpose of UNIFIL, given what's happened over the last week.
Wow. I mean, we've talked about how the UNIFIL mandate has changed, and that's obviously as Lebanon itself and the situation along its borders has changed. But Ireland, of course, during the course of the Irish involvement with UNIFIL has changed immensely. I mean, if we're talking about an involvement that went back to the 80s, you know, those were soldiers being deployed to Lebanon at a time when just across the border in Northern Ireland, there was a civil conflict going on. Maybe you could talk to me a little bit about the way in which Ireland's own history has shaped both public understanding and acceptance of its mission in Lebanon, but also perhaps the understanding of the soldiers engaged in these missions, of what they're doing and how they relate to the people that they're there to protect.
Ireland obviously has a history, a proud history in the United Nations of being involved in the, you know, decolonization movement in general, and indeed the process that was part of the United Nations in the 1960s. And so I think Irish people believe that there's a sort of standing up for the underdog is something that is very much in our history and something that we want to do. I think the, you know, for some people within the Irish military and for peacekeepers, they find themselves, you know, stuck between being highly, and indeed for UNIFIL in general, which of course is a very largely, you know, Asian peacekeeping mission with lots of, you know, contingents from India, from Indonesia, etc. And I think for a lot of troops and contributors, including the Irish in UNIFIL, it's enormously frustrating to be caught between, on the one hand, the IDF, which are clearly have inflicted so many civilian casualties in recent days, and of course the horrors of Gaza, you know, happening simultaneously. And on the other hand, you know, peacekeepers have found themselves under attack, you know, physical attack from Hezbollah at various points over the last number of years. And presently we see a situation where we have, you know, a murdered Irish soldier. Sean Rooney was killed less than 2 years ago, and it's still proving extremely difficult for Ireland to get the necessary cooperation from Hezbollah to bring the perpetrators of that murder to justice. So, you know, they find themselves caught between a rock and a hard place there.
Dr. Edward Burke is Assistant Professor of the History of War since 1945 and Director of the International War Studies MA program at University College Dublin. Now, before we move on to our next story, I have a quick announcement to make and also a request. The announcement first. We are delighted to be able to share with you that Inside Europe's coverage of the 2024 EU elections is a finalist in the Signal Awards competition. The request, you've probably guessed already, we'd like you to vote for us, please. We're a public service broadcaster, so we will never, ever ask you for money. But if you could help us out by taking the time to either go to signalawards.com or by clicking on the link in our show description, then we would be massively grateful. We know it's not going to change the world, but to be honest, in an era of public service broadcasting cuts, having an award up your sleeve can definitely come in handy. Now, if I were to tell you that there is a country in Europe where you can be arrested for clapping and the secret police are still called the KGB, would you know where I was talking about? The answer is, of course, Belarus. Incidentally, the country where a recent investigation by Die Welt newspaper revealed that AfD politician Jörg Dornau has been using prison labour, of which regime opponents make up a large proportion, to man his onion empire. But, you know, I digress. Our story this week is actually about the Belarusian language, which Putin ally Alexander Lukashenko has effectively outlawed in favour of Russian. Nevertheless, many young people are stubbornly trying to preserve the language. Levi Bridges has this report in which the names have been omitted for security reasons.
On a warm night in Minsk last summer, a YouTuber strolled through the city's cobblestone streets, taking viewers on a virtual tour. Street musicians and passersby are all speaking Russian. Under the Soviet Union, the Russian language dominated life in Belarus. But when the Soviet Union broke up, Belarusian became the country's official language. And there was a resurgence of Belarusian in the cultural sphere. In a video from a decade ago, a woman reads a poem in Belarusian from a crumpled piece of paper at a poetry reading in Minsk. But holding events like these is almost impossible these days. In 2020, police violently dispersed tens of thousands of people who gathered in Minsk to protest the fraudulent re-election of President Alexander Lukashenko. Many voiced their discontent in Belarusian as a way to protest the government, which has championed the use of Russian.
If you live in Belarus, speaking Belarusian could be considered as a political act.
I talked to one woman in Minsk, a poet, who said she was working at a bookstore that recently planned to have a small event where people would read a few poems in Belarusian.
I guess it was 1 hour and a half before the event, the bookshop got a phone call from the Ministry of Internal Affairs, and they talked to us, "You're stopping this right now, or we'll stop it, like, with the force."
They hadn't even made any public announcement saying they planned to speak in Belarusian.
Everyone who was in this bookshop working was arrested just randomly one night. I was just lucky that I was at home this evening, but we were trying to keep us safe as much as possible, but that didn't work. And I guess it's always like some kind of evil game, some kind of roulette.
Another woman in Belarus I talked to says she's defiantly speaking Belarusian with a circle of people she trusts.
But when I'm going outside in some stores or public places, it's more safe for me to use Russian, especially now when the police can detain you even for the language you used to speak.
She says using Russian is like a mask you can wear to hide who you really are. And speaking Belarusian where it's safe is a way to demonstrate that Belarus is an independent country, not part of Russia.
Without our language, we are not exist as the nation.
Belarusian is a part of many people's identity, even for those who don't speak it well. I spoke with a woman who started studying Belarusian intensely as a teenager. She eventually decided to speak Belarusian as much as possible and even think in the language. It was hard at first, but also a relief.
Because when I started speaking Belarusian, it felt like I became myself for the first time ever.
She says lots of people only get exposed to Belarusian on public transportation, where announcements are still made in Belarusian.
Осторожно, двери зачиняются. Наступит рынок. Областная филармония.
But in this YouTube video of a city bus in Minsk, the Belarusian part of the recording swiftly turns to Russian. Young people are now trying to inform others about Belarusian online.
Belarusian and Russian do have a lot of lexical similarity, but Belarusian is actually more similar to Ukrainian or Polish. Let's take the word for beat, for example.
Lots of Belarusian language media is now produced outside of the country. I talked to one man from Belarus in the EU who runs a social media project, all in Belarusian. He says even little things, like making a post with some yellow and blue, the colors of the Ukrainian flag, could get them blocked in Belarus. So they consult with people inside the country about what might get censored.
And they are telling us what they feel would be not safe to do. So we're very cautious about it.
The Ukraine war has made things even trickier. Recently, his grandmother, while half-speaking Belarusian herself, warned him not to use the language. He says people in Belarus are influenced by Russian propaganda.
That says, oh, you see, in Ukraine, people started to learn Ukrainian. And what happened? If you don't want to have war, don't learn your language. Learn Russian and keep quiet.
But the language persists as a form of resistance. Many writers and poets living in exile are translating their work into English and publishing it online.
For a little change, nobody cared what we were doing. We fought the summer heat, the winter snow. And when we discovered we ourselves were the language and our tongues were removed, we started talking with our eyes. And when our eyes were poked out...
Not everyone in Belarus is fleeing abroad, though. The poet in Minsk I met, whose colleagues at a bookstore were arrested, says she still has poems to write and texts she wants to translate into Belarusian.
There is not a lot of people in the world with whom I could speak Belarusian and with whom I could do the cultural work. And so the people in Belarus have a lot of things to do.
Writers from Belarus say it actually feels like the language is growing now, despite pressure from Russia. Levi Bridges, DW.
If you have any comments or questions about that or any of the other stories featured in the show, then our feedback address is insideeurope@dw.com. You're listening to Inside Europe with me, Kate Laycock.
European politics. It's complicated, right?
Luckily, there's a podcast that helps make sense of it.
It's called The Europeans.
Every week, we break down the biggest stories in European politics.
Can I disagree slightly with the premise of your question?
Go for it.
I think some European leaders may actually prefer Donald Trump.
And some quirky non-political stories you probably missed.
Vilnius, the G-spot of Europe. Nobody knows where it is, but once you find it, it's amazing.
The Europeans.
New episodes every Thursday.
45 years on, and it is still Norway's worst ever industrial disaster. On March 27th, 1980, the Alexander L. Keeland, a semi-submersible drilling rig platform, capsized on the Edda field in the North Sea, killing 123 people. At the time, the tragedy was attributed to poor welding, but many of those affected have long questioned the official story. Last weekend, families and survivors met in Oslo to support each other and to push for further state compensation for their losses. And, as Lars Bavanger reports, they are still looking for answers.
Harry Vika welcomes me into his flat in Stavanger, Norway's unofficial oil capital.
I came to Stavanger with a friend, and he... fixed a job in the North Sea at the Alexander Kielland platform.
Now in his 70s, Harry remembers vividly the night of the 27th of March 1980. He had just arrived on board the Alexander Kielland to start another few weeks of work. Soon after 6 p.m, he heard a loud bang as one of the platform's five legs snapped off in the storm. Just minutes later, the enormous floating platform capsized, throwing Harry in the water, and after nearly drowning twice, he managed to swim until he spotted one of the platform's lifeboats.
It was upside down. And there was a lot of people in the water outside this lifeboat. Together, we managed to communicate with those inside, and we managed to tilt it so we came on the right position.
The upturned rig had a deck area the size of a football pitch. Despite calmer weather today and the huge rescue operation, hope is fading of finding any crew member still alive, trapped in the submerged living quarters.
The next day, the disaster was international news. Harry Vika was one of 89 survivors. 123 men died. A public inquiry later concluded faulty welding by the platform's French manufacturer was to blame. A separate French investigation said additional factors were at play. Today, nearly 45 years on, survivors and families of those who perished still say they want answers.
My name is Magne Elin Øyerham. I was 7 years when my father died, Harald Øyerham. I remember we heard about it in the news in the evening in the North Sea, and we asked our mother, is that where our father is? And she didn't know.
Magni Erlin is now part of the Shellan Network, a group of more than 100 relatives and survivors who meet regularly to share stories. They're also working hard to find out more about what happened back in 1980 and to press for compensation from the Norwegian state.
There's so much information that we didn't know. Every time we gather together, there's something new. And so many archives that have been closed, things have been hidden, things have been done behind the survivors, behind their backs. It's also strange to know that no one have been held responsible for this. This is our life. We need to get some answers.
Norway has grown immensely rich from North Sea oil and gas. This remarkable industrial history is highlighted here at the Petroleum Museum in Stavanger. Those who gave their lives in the search for oil are also remembered, and a large part of the museum is given over to an exhibition about the Alexander Kielland disaster.
This is a huge piece of metal.
It is, and it's actually one of the bracings of the platform. It was a national catastrophe, and it was the biggest national industrial disaster in Norway, and it still is. It had a huge impact on the whole nation.
Elsa Tongland leads the museum's Alexander Kielland project and has spent years documenting what happened. It is important to the nation, but especially to the bereaved.
Some of them didn't even get their body or their father back. And they want to know everything about their father, how he died, what he was wearing, what was his last meal, and who was together with him. All these things are important. And they also have questions about the causes of the accident. Was it really just a welding arrow that led to this, or was there other things that could have contributed to the accident? So my job is to let people tell their story and also give as many answers to the question as possible.
Survivor Harry Vika is one of many who believe that a range of events led to the platform capsizing so rapidly with the loss of so many lives. Alexander Kielland was in the process of being turned from an accommodation platform back into a drilling platform, meaning many watertight doors that should have been shut were left open for easy access.
There was done work offshore that should be done in dock, and there was a lot of loose equipment on board because of this transforming the platform from accommodation to a drilling platform. So there was a lot of ongoing work that maybe have increased the risk and the result of this capsizing.
After pressure from the Kielland Network, the Norwegian Parliament in 2019 asked the Auditor General to assess the authorities' handling of the disaster. That report, published in 2021, said survivors and bereaved had been let down by the authorities, but it found no reason to reopen the investigation into the causes of the accident. Lars Bevanger, DW, Stavanger.
Case closed, questions open. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe.
Thank you.
This is Inside Europe, and I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. Out with the old, in with the new. But is it always that simple? Well, no, as we'll be finding out as we explore a sequence of stories from a continent in transition. Expect modern-day shepherds, post-industrial landscapes, lenient lexicographers, and edible insects.
It's very waxy.
It's very waxy, yeah, exactly.
Kind of like honey, maybe.
It's like, yeah, you can put it on your bread in the morning and you'll tell me, I'll give you a pot.
delicious.
Broadcasting from Germany. This is Inside Europe.
Let's begin with a pastoral, quite literally, because I want to talk to you about shepherds. Yep, shepherds, herders of sheep, those now almost mythical figures pictured in storybooks from a time when life seemed so much simpler and all a young person had to worry about was crying wolf at the appropriate moment. Well, shepherds are not quite gone yet. In fact, in Italy, no less than 4 shepherding schools have been founded, from Sicily in the south right up to Piedmont in the north. It's all part of an attempt to revive a profession that is seen as fundamental, not just for sheep, but for nature preservation as well. Angelo van Schaik drove up to Italy's oldest national park, close to Arezzo in Tuscany, to find out more.
A stable where a ewe is resting with her 2 newborn lambs. She's instantly alert when Gianluca Sestini and I enter.
They're 4 days old. All my sheep should give birth by the end of October, beginning of November.
Gianluca Sestini has 210 sheep. And he's one of the teachers at the shepherd school in the Parco Nazionale della Foresta Casentinesi near Arezzo in Tuscany. Sestini mainly teaches the practical side of the job.
The first thing they have to learn is to get out of bed early. You have to be in the stable around 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning, and then you start milking the animals. Most of the students have never milked a sheep or even seen one close up. Afterwards, I'll take the raw milk to my little dairy, where I make different kinds of cheese.
There they are, finally heading out of the stable. They don't seem to want to go outside, says Allegra Adani.
No, they don't want to go out because it's raining and because they're not used to going outside in the morning. Sheep are habitual animals. They normally go out into the mountains in the afternoon, so they're hesitating to step outside.
Allegra Adani is 35 and one of the 6 students in this year's course. Originally from Florence, she moved to the mountains near Arezzo a few years ago.
Until 2020, I worked in Florence as a web designer, but I wasn't really happy anymore with my job. So I decided to do something completely different. I took courses to become a mountain guide, in which you learn about nature, plants, and animals. And slowly I found myself more and more surrounded by animals, by sheep, by goats. I liked it a lot and wanted more. So that's when I decided to do this course.
In mezzo agli animali.
The course is now in its 2nd year and is primarily focused on nature conservation. The sheep ensure that the open fields in a national park are not overgrown by the forest. Despite the fact that the number of shepherds is rapidly declining throughout Italy, the school is popular, says spokesman Emanuele Perez.
Oggi anche sulla spinta.
We're seeing a growing return to the countryside by young people, and old farmhouses are being renovated by people who are fed up with busy, polluted cities. This course offers people a chance to learn a trade and earn money. They don't have to have experience or come from a shepherd family. Plenty of motivation is enough.
Allegra has done the 3-month theoretical course and is now doing several internships with shepherds around the national park. When she's done, she wants to have her own herd of animals.
I would like to have my own little herd of goats. I like goats more than sheep. They're more clever and more fun. And then open my own cheese dairy here in the village to make some money. My goal is to complete my transformation from web designer to goat herd.
After the COVID pandemic, there was a trend to leave the cities and return to the countryside. But the profession of shepherd is facing a long but certain decline. There are still more than 6 million sheep in Italy, but that's 6.5% less than 5 years ago. And as a result, the number of shepherds is also decreasing. The 4 shepherd schools now existing in Italy are an attempt to turn that trend around. But the question is if that's enough. Angelo van Schaik, DW, Parco Nazionale della Foresta Casentinesi, Tuscany, Italy.
Nowadays, in many parts of Europe, you're probably as likely to pass a field of wind turbines as a field of sheep. Yep, the times, they are a-changing. And nowhere is that perhaps more startlingly and visually apparent than in the shifting landscape of European energy production. Last week, the UK's last remaining coal-fired power plant was taken offline. Many other older power stations with their enormous concrete cooling towers have already begun to be demolished. But hundreds of people have joined an unlikely new campaign to save at least one tower as a monument to the country's industrial heritage. Lucy Taylor reports from the UK.
We're ready to go, lads. We've got shutdown available.
Yep.
Last time.
Yeah.
Okay, unit 4, shutting down.
With a click of a mouse, the last unit of the last coal power station was turned off for good.
Any second.
That's it.
Offload.
A decade ago, more than a third of the UK's electricity came from coal. But as of this month, that figure is zero. It was, they said, the end of an era. But the industry leaves behind dozens of huge decommissioned cooling towers, those massive concrete structures that spew hot steam for miles around. Ugly, perhaps, but those now empty towers have won some unexpected fans.
I just think there was something so uniquely imposing, beautiful, evocative, awe-inspiring about these particular structures. Not only actually in terms of their engineering, which are a work of genius, how these things stay up and do their job, but just in their scale, their size, their form. I think they're incredibly beautiful. And I know that's in the eye of the beholder. Some people will think, ugh, just get rid of them, these concrete monstrosities. But not me. I think they are both aesthetically and architecturally just gorgeous.
That's the playwright and screenwriter James Graham, who's written for the West End and Broadway. He grew up in the Midlands, near that last power plant, with its 8 famous cooling towers.
They greet you as these, to me, really friendly giants who say, you're home now.
And he's even been inside one of them for a TV drama he wrote.
And I've never stood anywhere like it on Earth. They are these because of the shape of them, they're these huge hulking bases that then narrow in the middle and then perpendicular up at the end. So you're in this huge amount of space, a cathedral of air that makes you look upwards at the sky through the funnel. They're big enough for the entirety of St. Paul's Cathedral to sit in. They're big enough for the Statue of Liberty to sit in. They're extraordinary. And it was a real privilege to stand there. Most people never get to stand in them. And I don't see why we can't keep a couple of these. I want that feeling of majesty to be shared by other people.
But if James wants to save them, he might need to be quick. They're being demolished, often 4 at a time. Where once there were more than 240 cooling towers across the UK, now there are just 45. But at 200 metres tall and in places just a few centimetres thick, what else could they be used for?
So we are the 20th Century Society. We're the national charity that campaigns to protect Britain's modern architecture and design heritage.
Ollie Marshall is leading the campaign to turn a cooling tower into something else.
So for your listeners in Germany, there's one at Wunderland Kalka, which is an amusement park in the Rhine. In South Africa, there's one which is an extreme sports centre and a bungee jump for those who are brave enough. Italy, there's a panoramic viewing tower over the lagoon in Venice. And there's another one which has been built into a corporate office block in Milan. So really, the only limit is your imagination.
His organisation is working with engineers and architects to work out the best use of a cooling tower in the age of sustainability.
We always make the point that if you look at the British landscape, you will see examples of power generation and energy infrastructure from previous centuries. Gas holder frames or smock windmills, factory chimney stacks or bottle kilns. They've gradually assumed the status of regional or national landmarks and have become hugely valued and appreciated. You know, the Industrial Revolution started here 260-odd years ago, and we're one of the first major economies to completely remove coal from our energy generation. So that's sort of quite a poetic punctuation mark on that, you know, on that enormously significant period in history.
But the operator of the last coal power plant says it has plans to turn that site into a green energy hub. And the government has said it wouldn't want the remnants of the old site to hold them back. So the iconic towers that campaigners call the Stonehenge of the 20th century could soon be not just heritage, but history. Lucy Taylor, DW, in the UK.
God is change, shape God. And if I'm quoting from the post-apocalyptic cli-fi novels of the late great Octavia Butler, then you know that things are serious. Oh yes, first they came for our cooling towers and now they are attacking our punctuation as well. There has been much impeccably spelt outrage expended this week in the comment sections of German newspapers after a key linguistic body, the Rat für Deutsche Rechtschreibung, ordained that a controversial piece of punctuation known as the Deppenapostroph or idiot's apostrophe is, in fact, perfectly permissible. Basically, we're talking here about the possessive apostrophe, like the one you'd find in Jackie's bar or John's pedicure parlour, only in German it hasn't traditionally existed. A grave situation indeed, then, which is why I called in the big guns. Frau Dr. Laura Neuhaus is vice editor-in-chief at the renowned monolingual German dictionary publishing house, Duden. I'm always curious when I meet serious logophiles, so I began by asking Dr. Neuhaus whether her own love of words dated back to her childhood. Had she been that girl at the front of the class who was always trying out big new words?
Actually, I would say quite the opposite. For me, it was not so easy to spell correctly in German classes, and reading didn't come easy to me. But I think later in university, this feeling of a lack sort of made me interested in what is behind all this. What is the system behind the language? How do we decide how to spell things, and why is one word spelled this way and the other word this way? And that there's actually a good system behind this, and it's sometimes complicated, but if you take time, it's fun and it's interesting.
It's a system whose rules are very carefully policed. There is this thing called the Rat für Deutsche Rechtschreibung, which I translate that as the Council for Correct German Spelling.
Yes, exactly. That's a good translation. And you say policed, that sounds so sort of dangerous. And I think it's really interesting that the spelling is the only part within the German language that is actually policed with actual rules like this. And the rest, like what kind of words we choose or what kind of style we choose, doesn't have this norms or these rules the way spelling has.
Okay, spelling.
Uh-huh.
This brings me to this week's controversy. So basically, what has happened is that the aforementioned Rat für Deutsche Rechtschreibung, the Council for Correct German Spelling, has decided that it is now officially permissible to use this incredibly controversial thing called the Deppenapostroph or the idiot's apostrophe. You're going to have to explain this for me, Dr. Neuhaus.
First of all, I would like to emphasize that I think it's quite harsh to call someone an idiot only because of their choices in punctuation, really.
People get very upset. I mean, it's not just the media. I mean, I found blogs dedicated to this.
Yeah, their social media pages, like on Instagram, they collect incidents of these kind of apostrophes. So it makes people emotional and it makes people kind of harsh. And I think people don't see there's actually a good point to make this choice to put an apostrophe in these cases, like Eva's hair salon, which is to highlight the name and to sort of protect the name, like let's say Eva, from this grammatical extra material, the genitive S. And I think in this way, the apostrophe has a nice little function to be this little barrier between the name and the additional grammatical information. And I would say it's actually quite clever to use it this way.
Why do you think it is in that case that this has become such an emotive issue? Why do you think that people do get so wound up by it? I mean, is it simply a resistance to change or is there something else going on?
I'm a linguist, so I'm not a psychologist, but I sometimes think that language is something that is so close to our hearts and our identity again. And I think when people call it idiots apostrophe, there's this other human need of mocking others.
You mentioned identity, and I just wanted to ask about that because language and national identity, cultural identity are very much intertwined. And I had wondered whether part of this was also a resistance to a perceived creeping anglicization of German culture.
I think you do have a point there because it's this identity thing and this, the English language is everywhere and it's the German language might be dying. People are really afraid of this. And working as a lexicographer and making dictionaries, there's so many new words coming from the English language into the German language. And each time we talk about this, there are people writing us and telling us, oh no, you're killing the German language. And I understand the fear, but I always answer, it's just not true. It's so interesting to look at these words that are coming from the English language into the German language, how they actually become German words. Just to give one example, now everybody is talking about AI and prompting. And of course, also in German, there was a need for the verb. And the German verb is prompten. The root is the English, but it has the ending of the German word. And all these English verbs work like this, like to match on a dating app. It's matchen. Ich matche, du matchst, and so on. Or to frame, framen. Ich frame, du framest, and so on. Or even nerdy has become the German word nerdig with IG at the end. And I think it's so fascinating how this just works, that people are using something they like from the English language and make it part of the German language and of the system. And this just shows that the German language is not dying. It shows how it is evolving and how it's growing.
Lenient lexicographer Dr. Laura Neuhaus there, vice editor-in-chief at the German dictionary publishing house Duden. She was speaking to me, by the way, from a linguistics conference in Croatia. This week, our Spotify poll is Living Life on the Edge. We want you to help us identify Inside Europe listeners' least favourite piece of punctuation. Vote for the semicolon, the colon, the apostrophe, the dash, brackets, ellipsis, or, as I like to call them, dot, dot, dot. If you'd like to test our spelling, why not drop us a line at insideeurope@dw.com. We promise to get back to you, but do be warned, there is perhaps a reason that we work in radio and not in print. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. Bravo Figaro, bravo bravissimo, a bravo Figaro, bravo bravissimo, fate fortuna, fate fortuna, fate fortuna, no maghera, la 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 la, fate fortuna, fate fortuna, fate fortuna, no maghera, fuori il fatto della città, della città, della città. Sorry, I hope you don't mind me talking with my mouth full. It's been quite a crazy day, and this is the first chance I've had to grab something to eat. I'm actually not quite sure what is in this sandwich, to be honest, but it's quite chewy and tasty. Anyway, in hopefully unrelated news, insects are expected to become an increasingly familiar component of the European diet as the continent experiments with environmentally friendly protein alternatives to meat. For the moment, though, it's the insect-based animal feed sector that's seeing the biggest growth, and Bulgaria is determined to be in on the buzz. Sorry. Bulgaria's first ever insect farm started producing animal fodder a year ago and immediately began kicking up a stink within the local community. Damian Vodnicharov has been finding out more.
Nasekomo, meaning insect in Bulgarian, is located just outside the capital Sofia's ring road. It is a large compound with loading bays lining its sides. And there's the smell too, the locals' main complaint against the plant. It is not pungent or repulsive, and to my nose it seems no stronger than the smell surrounding just about any industrial agricultural sites, be it a chicken or a pig farm. As I'm led into the building, I'm greeted by the company founder, Xavier Marcenac. A Frenchman living in Bulgaria for over 25 years, Marcenac was in the outsourcing business before deciding to turn to greener pastures.
I decided to try to find something more sustainable or something different, and I was inspired by companies in France specifically and big investment in this industry. Insect industry is a new industry that's starting about 10 years ago worldwide. And the basic of the insect industry that we want to use the insect to upcycle low-value biomass, for example, what we call waste stream or co-product from the agro business, like spent grain from breweries or waste from potatoes processing, etc., and transform it using the power of this insect into high-value ingredient.
This insect in question is the black soldier fly, which is highly resistant and grows quickly through its life stages. It is present in the wild, but it is a different creature from the annoying common flies that annoy people on hot summer days. At this point, Xavier Marcenac shows the various life stages of the fly in jars laid on the table in front of me. Some jars are full of crawling larvae. Others contain the flies themselves. The main food source here is the larvae themselves, which are extracted, deactivated, and pressed.
And from the press, we extract the protein meal and the oil, which is a butter. They need to be 45 degrees to become an oil.
It's very waxy.
It's okay. Very waxy, yeah, exactly.
Kind of like honey, maybe.
It's like, yeah, you can put it on your bread in the morning and you'll tell me, I'll give you a pot.
Is it safe for human consumption at this stage?
So it's safe, but it's not allowed. If we look into regulation, and what are these products used for? They're used for animal feed. So since 2017, so 7 years ago.
After an introduction to Nasekomo's products and business model, we head out for a tour of the factory. We zip up in protective clothing for the flies' sake. I am led through different chambers dedicated to the various life stages of the flies, eggs, larvae, and pupas. They are all laid out in crates with biomass that serves as a food source. It is also very, very humid. Xavier Marcenac switches to his native French as we make our way through.
It's really very humid as we're in a tropical environment. This is a tropical fly, so we need to maintain a humidity level between 72 and 75% and a temperature between 28 and 30 degrees, depending on the chambers.
These chambers are actually stacked with crates, which are moved about one by one in order to pour water on the larvae and food. It is a delicate operation and a daunting task. Half a dozen workers are watering day-old larvae. A worker is also leading me through a dark hatching chamber. Once again, it's full of crates holding pupas, the dividing line between immature and mature insects. They love light. As we shine a beam through the crates, there are millions of flies here.
Oh, they are excited.
Yeah, yeah.
And attracted to the light.
Yes, yes, and they react.
Are they hatching?
Yes, yes. Oh, here we have more.
The centerpiece of this factory is a large central hall with large conveyors carrying the grown larvae to be cleaned out from the feedstock they are growing in. They are next deactivated through boiling and dried. All this process is very high-tech, and it includes Google's AI models, says Xavier Marcinak.
Our robot passes through each day to ventilate, to plow and control, and to take readings. All our data is then uploaded to the cloud. We've licensed machine learning algorithms to improve our productivity, so the algorithm will tell us there's an issue with humidity in the factory, so here's the impact on production. And we can then see the solution. This is what we're trying to develop here.
This is another facet of the insect farming industry. It is so new that new technology and knowledge are being developed. They will also be valuable commodities in their own rights in the near future, which is why Nasekomo is working on developing its own AI models. The Nasekomo factory produces about 500 tons of fodder per year. At the EU level, insect protein is allowed in feed for aquacultures, pets, as well as pig and chicken feed. Fertilizer is also allowed on markets. It is made with the waste products of protein production, making insect farming a zero-waste industry, which is much more sustainable. Nasekomo's main markets are Germany and France. Bulgaria, however, has never been one. And reactions to the opening of an insect farm have been mixed, to say the least. There were protests against the facilities because of smells when it first opened in 2017 and when it relocated in 2021. Xavier Marcinak says, however, a lot of complaints were filed before the plant ever started working. Today, discontent seems to have quieted down after Nasekomo's management has been leading an open-doors policy to locals and officials. Apprehension is one of the main hurdles to overcome for insect farming, which at this point seems inevitable, as the United Nations argues that crickets need 6 times less feed than cattle, 4 times less than sheep, and twice less than pigs and broiler chickens to produce the same amount of protein. Demet Vodonicharov, DW Sofia.
When they talk about creeping change, I don't think it's usually meant quite so literally. That is just about all we have time for this week. Before we go, a quick reminder that we are after your vote. Inside Europe's coverage of the 2024 European elections is up for a Signal Award in the News and Politics Best Single Episode category. So if you would like to vote for us, do head on over to signalaward.com or follow the link in our show notes. Just a heads up that once you have voted, don't forget to click on the verification email. Thanks so much for your support. It really does mean a lot to us all. This programme was produced by Helen Sini with help from me, Kate Laycock, and sound engineers Gerd Georgi, Natalie Wittmann and Timon Haydon. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany.